has talked about it. And this informal economy, therefore, needs to be boosted every now and then. And we cannot do it if there is not enough cash flow in the economy. So I think the middle class, which India had created in the past 20 years, needs to be maintained. The cash should come into their hands. About the export, I don't think exports are have been very negative in the past, and still I'm not an economist by profession, but of what I hear and understand from my colleagues who are economists, I think there is a need. The exporting of raw materials itself is not a negative thing, because in today's market, even China supplies us with raw material for the market, for the medicines, which is a very essential commodity. So although there were talks about boycotting China due to the COVID and, you know, other things, there were sanctions that were being planned on China. But India cannot afford to do that in many ways, because we get a lot of raw material from there.
Another legacy of the colonial rule was deforestation of most of India's jungles, which were replaced by farms to draw in more taxes for England. Complex cultural identity crises were instigated by cultural transformations that were forced on the people, such as removing the Persian language and forcing the use of English language on a large scale. In addition to degrading the ancient culture of the region, this move stripped the future generations of their literary heritage. Furthermore, the colonialists founded the enmity between Hindu and Muslims, making way for the partition of India and endless clashes that continue to this day.
With the passing of UK's longest reigning monarch, who witnessed 15 prime ministers in her exceptionally long rule, many have questioned the impact of her years as a queen and how England's policies affected the destiny of so many nations. Between 1983 and 1987, she was the head of state for 18 countries and at the peak of her influence. But towards the end of her 70-year reign, she struggled with many scandals caused by the British royal family. So much so that the monarchy was called into question even by the islanders.
The British monarchy has been criticized throughout history for its centuries of oppression against other nations and indigenous populations across the world. With the death of the Queen, the rekindled memories of bitter colonialism and the continuation of their dominance in the subcontinent under a new disguise, the public perception in the region and other countries around the globe have once again shifted towards Britain's crimes and spoliation. Regardless of words of sympathies by politicians aimed at the people of Britain and the royal family, those who have lived or were born in colonized nations under British rule have mixed views, often riddled with criticism towards the role of Queen Elizabeth in a post-colonial era.
There are ways and means of influencing. There is some amount of neocolonialism that is being asserted by the West. But at the same time, we know that the other forms of it, mainly in the form of business acquisitions, and in that case, even China is one of them. The China is very much a world power, where through its trade policies and through its other aggressive policies, it is influencing India or Pakistan. And as we know, the global South, or the South Asian politics, is very much centered around China and Russia at the moment. I think it is not so easy for any new colonial agenda to flourish at this point, because we also have what we call a decolonization moment that is going on. People are now realizing that it's not, you know, the foreign political secession is not possible.
One of the legacies of the British rule is racism and slavery, a notion that has found its way in the new colonial mindset of the West. Today, large conflicts in South and West Asia that were triggered by colonial powers threaten world peace. Some former colonies are still ruled by corrupt officials with the same colonial mindset that still humiliate and exploit their own people. post-colonial studies show that despite official independence from Britain, the colonial interests are still represented in most of these countries in some form or another.
Most of Queen Elizabeth II's reign was in the post-colonial era, but the attitude towards previously colonized countries had not changed much in comparison. Britain still pursued its past colonial interests under different guises. In recent years, more and more British intellectuals and historians have called for the British monarchy to answer for its past colonial history. But we have never witnessed a formal statement or an apology by Queen Elizabeth II. Now, we have to see how Charles III will heed these calls.
Queen Elizabeth II ascended to the throne in 1952 and had a direct role in tens of civil wars and coups before she died. Before her reign began, nearly all British colonies had gained independence. It's fair to say the most impactful legacy of British colonialism for the subcontinent was its partition to India, Pakistan, and then Bangladesh. This partition caused the largest migration event in human history. Millions of people migrated from India to Pakistan and vice versa under horrific conditions. Sources put the number of the migrants at around 15 million, which cost 1 million their lives, who never reached their destination. Moreover, during the Bangladesh independence struggles in 1970s, nearly 500,000 were killed. The divide-and-conquer policy, a core political agenda implemented by British colonists, went as far as creating a constantly hostile relationship between regional states, especially India and Pakistan, despite centuries of shared history. Today, the Jammu and Kashmir region has become a center for an endless conflict.
If you look at the divide between Hindus and Muslims in India, I think the division is old, medieval, and we've had problems of coexistence of, other kinds of what we call cultural fault lines. You know, although people may exist together in the medieval period, the religions also fused together. Many of the texts, religious texts, for example, which are written in Persian, half in Gurmukhi, half in Persian, and these are the shared languages of the religious texts. So this sharing has gone on for centuries. So we should not forget that at one level, people have also fused the cultures together.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Saeed Khan. He's a lecturer and researcher from Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Khan, welcome to the program again. Now, what do you consider to be the most important aspect of the legacy of British colonialism in South Asia?
I think without a doubt it is the politics of division, the communal distinctions that were made as a result of the British policy of divide and rule. It allowed the British then to foment divisions that didn't really exist before, particularly along religious lines. And it served as a justification for them to then, in a very cynical way, prolong their stay in the Indian subcontinent or in South Asia to act as, in their minds and in their narrative, as some kind of an honest broker. I think the irony is not lost that they were the ones that created the divisions, and then they were stepping in to act as though they and they alone were ones that could then try to quell any of the kind of conflict and violence which would ensue, and in fact did ensue, as we see not only in the history of the independence movement and then subsequently partition, But even the impact now, as we see, particularly in India with the rise of Hindu fascism or Hindutva, and its targeting of religious minority communities, including Muslims, Sikhs, Christians.
Mr. Saeed Khan, manipulating the subcontinent's economy into ruin still has an impact on India and other countries in the region. So what's the way out?
Well, first of all, when it comes to the theft, there's of course, as some estimates place it, $45 trillion were stolen from India by the British colonial project, first by the British East India Company, and then when India passed over to be under the authority of the Crown, or the British government, more specifically. India at one time had, as estimates say, was responsible for producing 25 to 27% of the GDP of the world. It then went down to near the bottom rungs of such output. So you see the drastic effect that the British colonial experience had on them. And as you rightly said, there was also quite a bit of harm to the environment in two ways. One is the pillaging of land, in making it at a certain point unarable to grow crops. Those areas that then became fertile were used by the British for their own crops and their own purposes. And then, of course, we also see examples that when India was producing crops, those crops were diverted to British consumption, especially during World War II, leading to the famine in the Bengal in 1943, something that Winston Churchill, then the Prime Minister, willfully allowed to happen, and which many scholars and historians now would rightly call a genocide. But then we see more recently, for example, the environmental connection to the massive flooding that occurred in Pakistan with the melting of the glaciers. That was part of the industrialization era. And of course, Britain was a major contributing factor when it came to that. And so we find then that 150 years on, the subcontinent, both because of its geography and also because of its land misuse, has had to pay the price for what others had really then created, in being, without a pun intended, a climate of peril for the environment, for the fertility of the land, and then, as we see, the consequences of climate action and climate change.
Mr. Saeed Khan, with the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, we've seen a lot of calls to abolish the monarchy. Even in India, people on social media have asked for reparations for their stolen riches. What does that reveal, and what's your take on that?
Well, I think we have to be very careful here in whom to blame. I know that the monarchy is, of course, an easy target. It is symbolic. The British certainly present the monarchy and the monarch, the crown itself, as being the symbol of British power, in their minds, British virtue. But we also have to understand that especially when it came to the Indian subcontinent, the policy of colonialism was really directed from two sources. One was the British East India Company, and then really parliaments. I think it's important to recognize that within the British system, the monarch, of course, is the head of a constitutional monarchy, but his or her powers are certainly limited and checked by parliament itself. And so this very much was a governmental project of colonialism, less so the monarchy. Now, having said that, there are, of course, riches that were taken from India, including the famed Kohinoor diamond. In other parts of the British colonial experiment, we have the Star of Africa. And again, those are very symbolic. The Kohinoor is in the imperial crown. The Star of Africa is in some of the other jewelry that the monarch wears. But I think it's important to also consider that jewels are certainly important, I suppose, and they certainly have a lot of value, but they're nothing compared to the overall wealth that was stolen from the country, and also the kind of devastation for which we cannot go ahead and place a monetary value, including, as we discussed before, the communal violence and the conflicts that exist along religious and ethnic and caste lines in the country.
Mr. Khan, many analysts believe that the colonial agenda is still in play, but with a different method, even after the declaration of independence by South Asian countries. I wanted to see your thoughts on this.
Well, neocolonialism is real and neocolonialism still exists. It's a question, though, whether it exists within the context of the Indian subcontinent. Colonialism, as you know, is usually best defined either by extraction of an evacuation of people, extraction of resources, or it is defined by settler colonialism. Now, the British don't seem to be interested in settler colonialism in the Indian subcontinent. And the question then becomes, are they trying to evacuate people or are they trying to extract resources? It doesn't seem to be in either of those cases something that's going on with the Indian subcontinent. In fact, if anything, it seems as though the British are being rather deferential to India because they see it as a large potential consumer market, both for weapons and other consumer goods. So their posture with India has certainly changed. At the same time, the British do exercise neocolonialism elsewhere, for example, in the Arab world, invariably because of oil. So I think when we take a look at neocolonialism, we do have to take a look at it regionally and perhaps country by country and really assess whether it in fact exists with the Indian subcontinent anymore.
Before we wrap this up, sir, one last question. The late Queen traveled to almost every country on the map, but she never visited Israel, or should I say the occupied territories. Could you tell us why was that?
Well, there's a lot of conversation going on about this fact today after her death, and people have been raising it. Lord Pollock, who was the head of the Conservative Friends of Israel and the House of Lords, in fact, placed the blame on the British Foreign Office, claiming that it was they who prevented the Queen from making a trip to Israel for whatever were their policy reasons behind it. I don't know if that is really the case. Generally, the Foreign Office does coordinate with the monarchy quite closely. And in fact, many of the trips that the Queen took was on behalf of the British government in order to create goodwill. At the same time, it's quite possible that Lord Pollock may have been putting the blame on the Foreign Office instead of putting it on the monarch, because that would have been seen as unseemly, particularly at the time of her death, and an almost universal level of grief and support for Queen Elizabeth II during her passing. At the same time, we find that no monarch had really made a state visit to Israel. Granted that when the State of Israel was formed in 1948, it was only her father before her and then her who were the monarchs. And King George VI perhaps was too ill to in fact make the journey. Prince William did make an official visit in 2018 to Israel and visited the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And the Queen's husband, the late Prince Philip, had made an unofficial visit there. There are a lot of reasons why the Queen perhaps didn't travel to Israel, and people will go ahead and come up with their own presumptions. There are those who feel as though perhaps she was making a statement by not going and providing, in her own way, a criticism about the State of Israel. There's also the possibility, as I mentioned before, that the Foreign Office did not want that to happen. There's even another narrative that the Foreign Office didn't want her to go because they didn't want to upset many of states with which Britain has very close ties, and especially when it comes to its interests in the petroleum industry. So I suppose whatever her reasons were for not visiting Israel will go to the grave with her.
There you have it, Mr. Saeed Khan, lecturer and researcher from Detroit, Michigan. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Entrepreneur Ovia posted on Twitter that although Africans have chosen to forgive the Britain for colonialism, they cannot easily do it, since there is no way you can prevent a child not to cry after he has just been whipped. Karen Ataya, Ghanaian columnist, slammed the statement that, "Why are we speaking ill about Queen Elizabeth? Britain's colonialism and brutality was in the past." She pointed that the queen literally wore crown jewels plundered from conquests in India and Africa. Kia Juma, farmer, tweeted that as the Europeans do not mourn Hitler, we should not be mourning the Britain's queen too. Mentioning colonialism, he added that if they were such glory days, why not include it in their history lessons? Becca, entertainment curator and commentator, slammed the Britain for whitewashing the history and said that Great Britain's long-standing relationship with Africa is colonialism, pillage, genocide, theft, and exploitation.
And that was our episode about the legacy of British colonialism in South Asia and the political, social, cultural, and economic developments of regional countries from the beginning of colonization until today. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation after a long, long, long time.
The pleasure is all mine, alhamdulillah.
Well, in our previous episodes with you, we discussed the positives and negatives or pros and cons of social media, how they affect teenagers and what we should be doing. Now, I wanted to ask you that there are a lot of parents who are okay with, like, leaving their children and teens with for like more than 2 hours on screen, whether they are games or animations, and that too unsupervised. How can we bring awareness to both the parents and these children about the dangers of this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, so this is a very important question, and unfortunately we see this very often, as you mentioned. Parents somehow are very lenient or Perhaps out of lack of awareness of the dangers of video games and social medias. When I say dangers, inshallah, we'll talk about them in today's shows. And so it's important that we bring awareness to parents that leaving your children unsupervised. When we talk about children, we're talking about from the age of these days 2 to 3, all the way until their teens. To leave them unsupervised in front of the screen, even if it's games that are considered as children games, or perhaps you've kind of seen that there's no, adult content on it, then you perhaps feel that this is okay.
All right.
I want to show today that, inshallah, we need to really review how we deal with this and at least be aware of the challenges that we are facing when it comes to the screen as generally. And inshallah, we'll talk about the different types of screens and see that there is a concern that we need to have. This is the first step. See, before we start talking about, okay, what should we do about this, etc., I want to over here just kind of bring this concern, as you mentioned, because of parents who are very perhaps unaware or easygoing when it comes to their children watching TV and playing games.
All right.
So I'd like to talk about five major challenges that can come about when we are faced with the screen.
And what are those?
So I'll mention one, and perhaps it'll take more than a few shows to discuss this. But we can go them and discuss them and give examples as well.
Sure.
This can be for parents. So if parents are listening and you're joining us on the show, then these are things that we can think about. At least be aware of these challenges that come when our children are in front of the screen. But it's also for youth and teenagers that are watching this show and are also very much into video games, very much into animations, very much into Netflix and whatnot. For you to be aware of the things that you are consuming, because really we are consuming this, what has been given to us and fed to us on TV or on this on the screen. And so this is important for both categories of listeners, inshallah.
True. Brother Miqdad, you said that it's important for parents as well as the children to listen and analyze what is being fed to them. Inshallah, we'll expand this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a favorite game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about the effects of animation and screen and the knowledge that parents and children both should have. Yes, Brother Miqdad.
Before I mention the 5 points, just let me define. When we talk about screens over here, I want to kind of have a broad broaden definition over here. We want to include video games.
All right.
We want to include animations. We want to include movies or cartoons, or basically the world of animation, the world of video games, that which we are seeing only and that which we are actively engaging in as well. So whether it's video games or other types of games that we are engaged in. So this is what we're talking about, screen. So I'll give examples as we mentioned these 5 points, inshallah. So the first point that I like to highlight over here is that when we are in front of the screen, we have to understand that although we count this as entertainment, the producers count this as education. So we have this, and I think we mentioned this previously as well, that at the highest level of policy making, it's there, you can search it online as well. The policymakers of whether it's Disney or Pixar or video games count this and are very open about this, that this is part of our education of society, education of the youth. So they are trying to portray a worldview to you or portray a particular type of values or goals or principles or
beliefs
to you through these channels, whether it is through animations or through video games.
Yeah.
So this itself tells us, kind of opens a red light for us, and so a warning light saying, okay, hold on a second. If right now I'm just giving my child to a teacher who is going to then teach his children in a very amazing way as well, because perhaps one of the best ways to teach somebody is through subconsciously through the world of imagination, such as movies and video games. and pass on values and virtues and life principles and life goals and in a whole world view about how to perceive the world, basically.
Yeah.
So this is how it happens. So this is really brings about an awareness. And obviously, these things are in the hands of people that are very often not believing in God, not believing in the faith that we have. They have no concept of a hereafter. This is a worldview that is purely humanistic, purely secular, a non-godly worldview. And therefore, what they're portraying out there is something that's completely opposite to perhaps what you want your children to grow believing in.
All right. Well, Brother McLeod said that parents have to be aware of the fact that whatever the kind of animation or fantasy or world kind of things are being shown to them, their children, they need to be aware of that because the thing that is being shown may carry its own worldview, may carry its own beliefs, may carry its own policies and ideas, and it may be feeding us that, and parents and children both need to be aware of that. We'll talk more on that with you after a short break. Tell listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Brother Mekhtar. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about the animation world and fantasy world and how, what are its impacts on children and how parents can help them. Yes, Brother Mekhtar.
So just to illustrate on the point that we mentioned, take one particular type of worldview, and that is that girls should be free and should be free. Right, and the definition of freedom is to go against their culture, is to go against the belief that their parents have, is to go against their faith, to go against everything that has come down from their parents.
That is traditional.
That is traditional, and okay. To explore the world. And to explore the world means basically to break all the rules.
All the stereotypes.
Right, so this always often goes against hijab, often goes against the very fact of belief that we have. And this ideology, you can see it in so many different ways. In different. So just to give an example, Brave, for those who've watched the animation Brave, or Moana, for example, or Tangled. These are a couple of years old for the new generation, perhaps. But these are animations that you've seen that have exactly the same message out there, basically, that you're a girl. Mm-hmm. And to be able to be successful, to be able to be amazing, to be able to be... let's say beautiful, to be able to be something great.
Explore yourself,
you have to go against your parents. You have to go against your culture, against your beliefs.
Against,
and you have to go and explore the world. Exactly. Break rules, basically. Explore the world. Get out of the house, basically.
Yeah.
That kind of one theme that is portrayed in so many of these animations. I've just given you three examples, but it comes out across in these animations and in video games as well. You see the same things as well. So just to give you one idea, one example of how worldview is portrayed through these animations. Another example that we could give is the example of this game that's right now is probably one of the most famous games in the West, at least, Minecraft. So for those who play Minecraft, I remember I was speaking to a young boy. He was maybe nine years old. And I had a long conversation with him about Minecraft. And literally I was asking him, okay, because you know when we used to play video games, we used to play video games that have a goal, right? You have levels to pass and you have a bad guy to kill at the end or whatever it is, basically. So I asked him, okay, what is the goal of Minecraft? So he gave me one goal that you have to build something, whatever. And I asked him, okay, what about after that? And then he said this. And then what about after that? And then this carried on for literally for 10 minutes. We just kept on talking about what do you have to do next? And it just went on. And you realize that basically Minecraft is a sandbox game. A sandbox game means that it is a game that doesn't have a particular goal. You have to
just make... Just taking you from one level to another level.
No, there's no levels. It's just a game that doesn't have a particular purpose. Rather, you have to make your own purpose. So you've got different things to do, different tools and different things that you can build with. Mm-hmm. And you have no rules and you have no defined goal that you have to go and kind of search or fulfill. But rather, you have to be creative in a way to build your own purpose. Now, this, in one aspect, you go, okay, this is great. This is exactly what children should be doing. Correct. But this is based on a worldview that it's called existentialism, if you want to search up, teaching you that we don't have a purpose in our life and we don't have a goal in our life. We have to make our own goal in life, basically.
All right.
Whatever you are in this life is in your own hands, and you make your life whatever you want it to be. You make your success whatever you want it to be. If you want to be this and you define success as this, mm-hmm. and your purpose as this, then well and good, this is what your choice is.
All right.
While this is completely different from what Islam says. Islam says that you've been created with a purpose, you have a fitrah, you're supposed to reach a perfection, that's a defined perfection, that's an eternal absolute human perfection.
There's a goal,
there's a
purpose.
Goal, there's a path, basically. It's not just a blank check that we've been created with. But you see how this game kind of is built on a particular worldview that is portrayed in this type of
in these type of animations and games. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much for providing so much information. We'll talk, inshallah, more on that in another session. Thank you so much to our listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us, please feel free to contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can listen to this program again on our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Jannah wasiyul mustafa haqqan imamun nas wal jinnah aliyun hubbuhu junnah qasimun nar wal jinnah wasiyul mustafa haqqan imamun nas wal jinnah aliyun hubbuhu junnah qasimun النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 30th sermon. This is the sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam stands up and addresses a group of people that made some very false claims against him. They say that he's the one who murdered Uthman. Yes, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not in good terms with the third caliph because of certain actions that he was performing that weren't very much at par with Islamic governance. And therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam even tried to advise him, and this is there in history. You can read Tariq Tabari, you can read Tariq Ya'qubi, even you can read the Sharh of Nahj al-Balagha or the interpretation of Nahj al-Balagha written by Ibn Abi al-Hadid, who was also a Sunni, by the way. All of this is there recorded in history, and you can see it. I mean, we don't have to, this is an intellectual discussion, and I expect all the listeners to have that intellectual, you can say, patience to be able to bear certain realities that happened in history that have been recorded by both sides. And how Imam Ali alayhi salam reacted to this, and especially Imam Ali alayhi salam was after training the people to understand events that occur in the society in the most appropriate of manners. Now, we said in the previous session that Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and he says that I'm going to conclude for you this issue, and he brings about this whole discussion about what happened in a very beautiful way. The actual reason was for people to understand that, look, events that happen in history have a reason. I mean, when they happen, and if there is a certain effect, note that that is something that can be repeated. In other words, there are certain principles that govern historical events and even events in the society. If a person is a dictatorial leader, then he will face a certain reaction. This is something that happens. This is something that you need. But of course, it is not something that just any sociologist can sit down and, you know, draw up. You need a person who understands the workings of God to be able to also interpret in a divine manner. And that was Imam Ali, that was what Imam Ali al-Islam was doing.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam also, if you notice, in this particular situation, Imam Ali alayhi salam, after saying "Wa ana jami'un lakum amra," he summarizes the whole issue of Uthman and what happened to him in just a few sentences. He says that "Walillahi hukmun waqi'un fil musta'thiri wal jazi'," that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a certain ruling, has a certain dictate, has a certain, you can say, principle. حُكْمٌ وَاقِعٌ. It is a ruling that happens. It is a It is a principle that you know that actually occurs, that manifests itself in the society. Regarding what? Fil mustathiri wal jazir. When there is a dictator and there is an oppressed and there is a dictated. Whenever in the society there is a dictator and there is a dictated, there is an oppressor and there is an oppressed, there is a forcer and they are the forced. Whenever this happens, there is a principle that overrules the society. There's a divine principle here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to remind them. Just like when oxygen and hydrogen come together and there's a spark, boom, something happens, something specific happens in that specific environment. Here also, when there is an oppressor and there's an oppressed in a society, there's something that occurs, there's something that happens in the society. And that is a clear ruling of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is what we are talking about, the sunnah of Allah. Those general divine principles that govern the society. And this is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to awaken the people towards.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam here says, إِنَّهُ اسْتَأْثَرَ فَأَسَاءَ الْأَثَرَ, that he says that unfortunately Uthman, he acted dictatorially. He became a dictator. He acted based on his own thinking and his own, his own whims, you know, in his own way. And it was not only a simple thing. Like if he would just be dictatorial in a few things and just in small things. No, he acted in a completely dictatorial way. فَأَسَاءَ الْأَثَرَ. And it was a bad form of dictatorship. Let me give you examples. These are in history. These are not some things that we are just, you know, pulling out of our pockets. This is something in Tariq Tabari. If you visit Tariq Tabari in the section of the Caliphate of Uthman, you will see that these things happened. That there are people, for example, who came and complained against Uthman. Okay, they were saying that, you know, that a certain governor in a certain place is doing a certain bad thing to us and he's doing some form of oppression. So when they come to them, they come to Uthman, Uthman orders that their hair is supposed to be shaven. He orders their heads to be shaven completely. And then he makes them, he makes them sit on donkeys. And then he pushes them and drives them, tells people to drive them in the gullies and alleys of that city while they were whipping them from behind to teach them a lesson that they are not allowed to complain against the governors. Now, you tell me, what form of dictatorship is this? Like, you cannot complain against a leader who is making mistakes, who is doing an error. So if, for example, if a group of people come and complain against this leader, then this is how he reacts. You notice that because of these forms of reactions that were not only once or twice, they were repetitive, people got tired, and of course they took the steps that were they thought were necessary at their time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
economic divide.
The fall of the dollar is gaining momentum. The Ukraine conflict has speeded up that process, especially since China and Russia have said that they would trade their oil in their own currencies. Given that the infrastructure is in place for the financial transactions and U.S.'s rocky economic state, will the dollar demise occur sooner rather than later? Hi, I'm Kavit Tavli. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said de-dollarization is inevitable. Is it? We will question that. Also, China and Russia accelerating their moves towards that. One of the consequences, a positive one for them, minimizing U.S. sanctions impacts. Also, de-dollarization contagion. The BRICS countries, they got together, the 14th session, and they said, we're going to have a new reserve currency. Also, strengthening bilateral trade in their national currencies, another move towards de-dollarization. And finally, a look at central bank reserves reducing dollars, exchanging to the yuan. Good news for China. That shows that the dollar is losing value. Saudi Arabia and Israel following suit.
The de-dollarization trend, which was in the making for years prior to the Ukraine war, has gained momentum following the latest crisis. Russia and China have decided to ditch the dollar in their bilateral trade and business ties. Beijing and Moscow have initiated programs and signed de-dollarization agreements to protect and shield their economies from U.S. governments. By 2020, less than half of bilateral trade transactions between these two countries were in dollars. This has gained pace following the recent tensions. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently said that the process of de-dollarization of the global economy is inevitable. Other countries are also joining the trend. Venezuela, Turkey, Pakistan, and Iran are also joining the process.
The dollar and the online reaction to what the Russian president has said overall, looking at how de-dollarization is inevitable. Responses are varied, but many, as opposed to before, are pointing to the direction of the dollar's value decreasing and for it not to have that international standing or the superior standing as it has been interpreted before. Take a look at our first post here, a U.S. CBDC, a currency that's digital in nature, is being examined to help the U.S. dollar's international standing. Translation, de-dollarization and losing the world reserve currency status. Got some gold or silver?
Are examining whether a U.S. central bank digital currency would improve upon what is an already safe and efficient domestic payment system. As our white paper on this topic notes, a U.S. CBDC could also potentially help maintain the dollar's international standing.
Next, China and Russia moving to disrupt the dollar's dominance in oil markets, where it goes on to say, this particular entry, Russia and China are making moves to dethrone the U.S. dollar in global oil markets. Russian and Chinese hydrocarbon giants Gazprom and China National Petroleum Corporation have agreed to switch payments for gas supplies to rubles. Then it elaborates more. China has long regarded the position of the renminbi, or the yuan, in the global league table of currencies as being a reflection of its own geopolitical and economic importance on the world stage. Okay, Russian companies is our next post saying that the shift to the yuan is happening as flight from dollar accelerates. Then, are you ready for the Great Reset? This was something that makes very much big news when it was announced because it is something that is a work in progress. And the WEF, or the World Economic Forum, said America's dominance is over. By the year 2030, we will have a handful of global powers. And finally, our next online post, the U.S. dollar's global standing as a top reserve currency has lost ground to China's yuan and others. So that's what we're looking at in terms of online posts, many of them pointing to the direction of the dollar's dominance nearing or reaching or accelerating towards its end. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. First up, we have Jayanth Tharapal joining us. He's the editor of the Oriental Despot website. He also has written a piece called How Declining Currency Hegemony Leads to War. All right, welcome to the program, Jayanth Tharapal, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Let me start with that in terms of what he has said. De-dollarization is inevitable. Now, we've heard that before, and we've heard many who have said that the dollar's international standing is not as high as it used to be. What are the reasons behind that? Are we looking at the Ukraine conflict maybe contributing to this? Because this is a stance that has happened before. How do you see the dollar standing right now?
Well, thank you for the question, Kaveh. Look, the sanctions on Russia are actually unprecedented in that the targeted currencies, the targeted country's currency is actually strengthened. This has never really happened before. Usually what happens is that the United States imposes sanctions on a country and the targeted country experiences a rapid depreciation of its own currency. But this hasn't happened with Russia, and that's because Europe needs Russian energy. Turns out that the German economy, you know, worth about $1 trillion, or the European economy worth about $1 trillion, was ultimately sitting on a foundation of something like $40 billion worth of Russian energy imports. That's how important Russia is. So without those energy imports, Europe cannot produce the high value-added manufactured goods that it's known for and that backs the value of its currency. So So BRICS has expanded its trade with Russia as well, and that's the other reason why the Russian currency hasn't depreciated too much. And over the past, you know, if we look at the long term, over the past 6 years, the composition of foreign exchange reserves data that you get from the IMF shows that U.S. dollar reserves are actually falling. So in 2016, U.S. dollar reserves were 65% of global central bank balance sheets. Now it's 58%, which is doesn't seem like much, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually quite big, especially when you consider that 20, 30 years ago, it used to be about 80%.
Indeed. Let's find out what our guest thinks about what our guest there talked about the dollar and its dominance. Bradley Blankenship joins us. He's a Prague-based American journalist. He is also a political analyst and a freelance reporter. Well, Bradley, welcome. Taking a look at what our guest there said in terms of the standing of the dollar, he talked about Russia. Russia is part of the BRICS summit. I'm sorry, BRICS grouping of countries, of which the summit was just held, the 14th one. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are the members. And the Russian president announced about this intention to develop a new international currency, a reserve currency, to target the U.S. dollar status. Is that going to work? Because we're looking at a grouping of countries, and perhaps this is something that may spread to other countries.
Yeah, that's right. So the leaders talked about creating a basket of their currencies to use in international transactions instead of the dollar. And I think because, you know, if you look at how important these countries are, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then, of course, you have other countries like Argentina now wanting to join BRICS, maybe Saudi Arabia is going to join BRICS. You know, this represents a real serious challenge, like a serious alternative to the dollar, because these are very important countries. And I think that these countries will become even more important. The thing is that the global south is going to be in the next few decades the hub of global development. This is going to, you're going to see the most GDP growth in these countries. It's going to be you know, the best investment opportunity. And so I think that these currencies will be more valuable and more lucrative to trade in. And certainly, as I said before, how the U.S. dollar was the lubricant of the global economy, I think you'll see that these currencies will be even more important as there's more investment in these countries. And then, of course, more cooperation between them.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program. This is where we review news from around the world with an economic flavor. First up, we take a look at a summit by the name of SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in which Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, called on SCO to confront U.S. unilateralism through new approaches, something he said at this summit. Now, one of the solutions, sustainable trade between the SCO members, through joint development of infrastructure such as financial transactions. Note, financial transactions, very important because they would like to sway away from the dollar, which is the topic of our program. All right, next up, there's been a seizure by Germany. What has occurred? Well, the country has seized control of Russian oil refineries, and that's big news for Germany in a sense. but yet the confrontation escalates with Russia. The move of Germany is aimed at ensuring the operation of three local Rosneft facilities after service providers allegedly refused to work with the Russian company.